This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahman, and welcome to Night School, the show that walks you through fundamental concepts in the social sciences and humanities. Together with Sharat Kutan, this show tries to reveal how various thinkers have grappled with theories and frameworks the better to understand how society works. Each week, we discuss a classic text or an idea we hope to shed light on the world around you. This week, we're going to be talking about optimism and pessimism, particularly by way of five very famous quotes or concepts. But first, let's welcome back Sharat. Sharat, it's good to have you back.
Well, I've not really been away. It's just been a couple of weeks.
Three episodes, actually.
Has it been that long?
Yeah. Well, it's good to have you on board again. It's a very interesting time to talk about optimism and pessimism, especially as Malaysians.
Yeah, we've, you know, coming up to the celebrations of independence, we've just had the hoopla down south with Singapore and its independence. Mm-hmm. And I wrote a piece, actually, for Focus Malaysia, my column, and reflecting on the work of Kishore Mahbubani, who says that Singapore has the right to claim that it's one of the most successful societies in history. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting for me was that he, you know, in some sense, they have a right to talk about or ask that question, you know. And it really was, even though Kishore Mahbubani's was a kind of assertion, I think it was much more of a question. Mm-hmm. For us in Malaysia, is that even a question? I mean, could we even legitimately ask that, considering all the troubles we've had of late?
I think the troubles of late suggest that things might not get better anytime soon either, because of all the work that's needed to improve the fundamental sort of frameworks needed to think of a better state of affairs. And which leads us to the original topic, I guess, on the idea of optimism itself and all that it implies, you know, hopefulness, certain desire for improvement, the possibility of progress.
I was a bit hesitant to mention this, but I think we probably should mention also the question of Bersih, which is the question of kind of active involvement in your world, right? So, you know, and I don't, I mean, one of my first thoughts is I was interviewed for a youth magazine recently, and they asked me, you know, despite all my pessimism, what would I suggest to young people? And I say, get involved. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that in any kind of facile way, because I'm not quite sure what works for each of these individuals in terms of involvement and what kind of involvement. But just the very idea that one has to be involved, I think, was what I was trying to put forward.
I agree. I think that's a good starting point. Not fussing so much on the particular details or a particular medium, but just be activated. You know, just be sensitive to the options you have to play a role.
So, okay, so the first proposition we have comes from one of our favorites, Karl Marx, from the middle of the 19th century. And he's reflecting on the politics of his time in the 18th Brumaire of Louis de, Bonaparte. And he says, and this is a very famous quote, I quote here, "Men make their own history, but they do not make it as they please. They do not make it under self-selected circumstances, but under circumstances existing already, given and transmitted from the past. The tradition of all dead generations weighs like a nightmare on the brains of the living." You know, okay, so if you kind of exclude that last part of the quote, it's up to that point, even possibly a positive statement about people in history.
I like that impulse that you had there to kind of exclude and highlight the first portion of the quote, because I think Marx, we should recognize that Marx is a dialectician. And in dialectics, to briefly summarize, is the idea that movement happens through contradictions. The idea that any direction society takes will be as the result of the outcomes of two opposing forces. And for Marx, this was between capital and labor. But you can abstract this to kind of larger lessons, you know, the idea that we can't be optimistic without a darker side to the hope, you know, and that similarly, what he's trying to say here, we can't think of changes without kind of looking back at what's happened in the past. And for that reason, we cannot just willfully demand and hope for our wishes to come true. We must work within the circumstances given to us. And I think that's a very, very important insight that we should keep in mind, that of course we want Malaysia to be, you know, an ideal society for all races, where inequality isn't going to be there. But fundamentally, we have to work with the raw stuff, the raw material that's given at this particular social juncture.
Yeah, so the question, I guess, for a lot of analysts and commentators and pundits are, what are those givens? Because I think there's a lot of disputes about what actually constitutes a historical given in the Malaysian context. But even before that, I think what's important to note about Marx and his assertion here is that much of the social sciences and social theorizing, I think, of the last two centuries revolves around the twin of, you know, agency and structure, right? Mm-hmm. So you see, in some sense, history is structure. So history is what we can push against, but is there limiting us. And agency is the idea of that appeals to some of free will, of voluntarism, of the ability to act on the world. So structure acts on us. Agency is us acting on structure.
Correct.
And so those tensions, I think, are in that statement. So he's in some sense making a very sophisticated claim, you know. And, you know, it may be contrasts with the latter-day existentialists who really, in many ways, promote the idea of the essential agency of the human being, right? The human being must act in the world as if they're completely free. I mean, that, you know, that many of the excuses we make for ourselves for not acting are bad faith, for instance, right?
But there's also in existentialism the idea of being in the world. For example, in Heidegger's case, where we are always already engaged and caring towards our surroundings, that any action must entail some confrontation with the broader circumstance in which we are thrown or we find ourselves. And that is, I guess, somewhat analogous to what you said earlier about structure as being the amalgamation of all the concrete and contingent circumstances that we must work with. Malaysia is very interesting in that for the first time, we have a kind of national public sphere in the form of social media. So I think that is the interesting historical moment for us. For the longest time, dissenting voices could be easily curbed because media is much more easily monitored. Now, with the growing access to this platform, there's greater hope, but at the same time, greater anxiety.
Coming back to the maybe the disputes we might have over what are the given facts. And you mentioned something about race earlier. And, you know, Malaysian, in the kind of realist mode of political analysis, always say race is a given. Of course, by race, we mean ethnic identity as one of the modalities in which politics operates. But, you know, it was only a couple of decades ago, maybe more than a couple of decades ago, when the ideas of those ethnic identities weren't so congealed, so ossified, or so certain. There was much more fluidity, and, you know, and politics was much more fluid as a consequence, right? Now we think of this as a given, but what is given today about race might actually disappear in the future. Just, you know, recently a politician came out and said, well, the demographic changes suggest that because of the increasing number of Malays and Bumiputras, that this will, our politics will always follow suit, that we'll always have a politics, you know, of a majoritarian nature. And I don't know that's true. I don't think it follows so in some sort of simple way in that.
Yeah, I am a bit more pessimistic in that sense, because the circumstances that we find ourselves is such that we cannot, regardless of theoretical positions we hold about race, fundamentally, we have somehow been habituated, even instinctively, to use, at least, at the very least, use these labels. There's a conversation that I always have within my circle of activists or academics on how we should really rethink or decenter this whole notion of the Malay, for example. You know, and I take a more pragmatic view in that while, yes, it's not ossified. It shouldn't be. Race is fluid. But the starting point is that we must at least recognize the value of this term. And it doesn't have to be a kind of mythical value or anything, but the fact that people relate to it.
Yeah. You know, it resonates
correct,
to people.
Correct. And it doesn't have to be on any ontological, realistic assumptions that guides this use, but that there is a certain idiom that goes with this term, the arts associated with it, the nuances and the subtleties
and people can
of
be
culture.
Mobilized, I correct. Think, most important.
Correct, correct.
I think there are other things, and we might think of the history of the Federation, the formation of the mm-hmm. Federation, not just of the peninsula, because that's also one
true,
federation
true.
Entity, that's it's a federation, but the larger federation of Malaysia. Mm-hmm. And we're already seeing all kinds of tensions yes. within the federation in the peninsula and then the federation writ large. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, the Sabah, Sarawak and, mm-hmm. And Peninsula Malaysia Federation. And so, yeah, so I mean, I think, again, there are going to be disputes about what are the given circumstances that we make history in. So mm-hmm. we are making history. We can make history if you agree with Marx, but those are the circumstances.
I agree.
From a materialist to a religious thinker, mm-hmm. This time an American theologian, Reinhold Niebuhr, and something he's very famous for, mm-hmm. Called the Serenity Prayer. Mm-hmm. Which apparently you'll find in many, this is because it's an American context, many American dorms and such, right?
Correct, correct. It's become very meme-worthy. People make memes of it and share it on Twitter and Facebook all the time, yeah.
Okay, so I'll read it. You know, me, mm-hmm. the atheist, will read a prayer, but here it goes, and I hope I don't get struck down. O God, give us the serenity to accept what cannot be changed, the courage to change what can be changed, and the wisdom to know one from the other. Mm-hmm. Sounds simple enough, mm-hmm. And in many ways sounds like a call to resignation.
Yes.
You know, a kind of quiet acceptance of the world as it is. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But is it really?
Well, I think it's a bit more hopeful than that. I mean, it's a prayer, first of all. So it's a gesture to elevate one's perspective, elevates one's spirit first and foremost. But I do like the fact that it recognizes the limits of what we can change. And for me, this is very important, because if we are to really commit to this whole idea that the world is changeable and that we can play a part, that the agency is powerful, then the second question is always, what exactly do you want to change and why? And at that point, you have to really recognize that there's only so much you can do. So this is a good call to moderate our investment, to moderate our emotional
expectations
as well, as we trudge through the very complicated waters of social change.
So, okay, so I was reading an essay on his major works on religion and politics. It was a piece in the New York Review of Books by Adam Kirsch. It's called The Ironic Wisdom of Reinhold Niebuhr. And I was taken by how it began with the Serenity Prayer and talked about how the prayer really is a call for the acceptance of responsibility. I'm just going to read a very quick mm-hmm. quote from the piece. It says, "It's up to each individual to examine himself and the world to find out how much they need to be and can be changed. It is only when the limits of this change are reached that we are allowed the consolation of serenity." Mm-hmm. The Serenity Prayer is actually a prescription for a strenuous moral life.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, the play of serenity with strain. And I'm not a big fan of serenity, but I do understand it as I understand its appeal. The idea that there can be moments of tranquil, at least. But I think the recognition of a strenuous moral life is very key there, in that being good, so quote-unquote doing the right thing, is full of strain. And I think that's what the prayer tries to speak to.
Apparently, Niebuhr, who wrote many books on American political life and choices, this is how he saw religion, right? So he says, and I quote here again, "An adequate religion is ultimate, you know, an adequate religion is always an ultimate optimism which has entertained all the facts which lead to pessimism." Again, we have this facts and pessimism and optimism. And mm-hmm. I think this wonderful mix that we have to, you know, somehow come to terms with, really engage with. What are these facts that lead to pessimism, and how can we still be committed to optimism despite the facts?
I agree. That's a great point, Sharad, and a good note to end the first half of the show. To note the twin or the wedded nature of optimism and pessimism, and how we cannot understand one without the other. Let's pause for a minute and we'll be back to pursue this line of thought in greater detail. You've been listening to Night School. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, and alongside me as usual is Sharad Kutan, and this is BFM 89.9. You're listening to BFM 89.9. This is Night School. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat. Joining me as always is Sharad Kutan, and we're talking about the relationship between optimism and pessimism, and we've surveyed two quotes, the first being the famous one by Marx about how humans do not make history under circumstances of their own choosing. They're always burdened by context, by the legacies of attempts before them, and of course the famous Serenity Prayer that allows us to be more graceful in accepting what we cannot change. Where do we go from here, Sharad?
Well, you know, so what we cannot change is part of the prayer by Reinhold Niebuhr. The other part is, in fact, to have courage. Mm-hmm. So courage is a key notion in that prayer as well. And courage to do what? To change what can be changed. Mm-hmm. So I think to do an honest assessment, and this is apparently what Niebuhr was as a theologian. He was a theologian deeply involved in the politics of his time. Mm-hmm. He was, very moved by the events surrounding the Great Depression in the early 30s, after the 29 crash. He went on to talk about what was necessary and talked about class politics. He weighed in on the question of revolutionary politics. So again, this is not some sort of simple-minded mm-hmm. or, poetic gesture. It really is a call to take responsibility. So courage. And courage, I think, relates to the question of action, mm-hmm. right? So we talked about agency. Courage is, how would you call it? It's the kind of moral sentiments that we attach to action, mm-hmm. right? Because to act courageously is to act in a way that wouldn't have been easy, mm-hmm. right? Isn't yeah. that yeah. what courage
definitely.
Is?
Definitely. We wouldn't recognize it if it's not of value because it's rare.
Right. So it is extraordinary times, extraordinary action taken perhaps for a higher cause. And I think that's what is also part of Niebuhr's Serenity Prayer. A complex statement really about the human being in the midst of mass politics against extraordinarily powerful states. Mm-hmm. They were coming into being during the early part of the 20th century mm-hmm. in a way that perhaps Niebuhr couldn't even imagine mm-hmm. that have come to pass, the mass surveillance and such. But what does an individual do in the face of that? What constitutes courage mm-hmm. in the face of authoritarian rule and the stranglehold of the state?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Actually, Sharad, that's great that you mentioned courage, because courage is also the moment when thought is suspended, that we act in conviction to propel us, to be called upon, to rise to the occasion. And at this point, we put aside or put behind the doubts that would hold action, the kind of reasoning, the endless chain of contemplation that would highlight all the dangers. All of that is put aside for a certain hope. And this harks to another quote, a favorite Marxist of mine, of many Marxists, in fact, Antonio Gramsci, Italian member of parliament, political prisoner, very animated life, and he has a very famous saying, and that is the pessimism of the intellect and the optimism of the will. The idea that fundamentally history, social change, is really determined by the wills, collective will or the will in general of a society or community being called upon to act and seize power.
Now, the question is, we turned things around a bit and said, well, pessimism of the will, optimism of the intellect. I mean, isn't that also a possible permutation when you look at those terms? For when you think of the kind of utopian thinking that animated so much of intellectual life in mm-hmm. the West, following the Renaissance and whatever, that people do believe. I mean, even in the last century, right, in the 60s and 70s, the mm-hmm. ideas of workers and students coming together in solidarity to overthrow mm-hmm. exploitative regime. There was this feeling that, if one thought about it intellectually, and this is in fact in many ways the Marxist project, it's a kind of utopian mm-hmm. project, it is deeply optimistic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people would say, in fact, I think realists and conservatives would say, well, the problem with Marxists is, oh, it's a great idea. You know, communism is a great idea, but it's so unrealistic. I mean, come on, get real, you know.
But
the charge against the Marxists is not pessimism, but in fact, unrealistic optimism.
But I think that's an example of the pessimism of the intellect, right? The idea that you can take any number of imaginable scenarios and find reasons to be against it. And I really believe you can do the equal gesture of thinking of as many possible optimistic scenarios and be for it. I think there's a level at which contemplation allows for anything, you know, because it's an abstraction. There's really no price to pay in imagining these different things. But in defense of Marxism, it's not the first time on this show, it does find itself always in a dialectic, that there are always tensions. And that when we want to be optimistic, it is not a blindly sanguine or a blindly joyful march towards, a communist future, but that it is born out of struggle and that the struggle will be complicated. And really, I find that much of the pessimism is not so much against the idea of one day having a more just society, but the price it would take for that real structural change, the violence that it might take, the confrontation that might ensue. And this is really what deters people. So I would refine that a bit. Is the pessimism against the ideal or against the process that it demands?
Well, okay, I'm going to bring Niebuhr back into this discussion because he did, in fact, weigh in on revolution and violence, though it says in this piece that he did change his mind somewhat later on. But okay, so I'm going to quote from the piece. It says, "If a season of violence can establish a just social system and can create the possibilities of its preservation, there is no purely ethical ground upon which violence and revolution can be ruled out." So it's a curious thing, right? He seems to be making the argument that perhaps, and he uses the word season, so the idea of a transition. The question, of course, is that, and we turn to history to understand this, mm-hmm, what mm-hmm. happens when you have certain types of violence, mm-hmm. Whether, in fact, it somehow distorts the very thing mm-hmm. that you're trying to create.
What is a pure ethical moral ground for any social change? Because I think at some point, at the very least, people be offended. You know, there's always a price to pay. There's always some kind of cognitive dissonance that we cannot avoid. You know,
and then somebody's going to pay that price, especially those who benefited from the system,
correct,
as it existed, right? Correct. So yeah, I do agree that there is the kind of ethics that Niebuhr apparently advances is a messy one.
But I do want to just highlight this very key point that I think a lot of moralists forget: being nice, or our investment in being nice, is not the same thing as our investment in social change. Those are two different things. We can be really nice and polite and courteous and jaga hati, like really make sure everybody feels good around us, but nothing changes. Ecological drugs destruction will continue, inequality will remain high, and so forth. So sometimes and it's a religious tendency, we can talk about the narcissism behind it, to conflate the two. That if I'm nice to everybody, if everybody around me feels good, then that's enough. Right, but social change demands things like liberation, structural adjustment, and I think it's at the confrontation of the costs that we really feel the tug of war between optimism and pessimism.
Yeah, I mean, one thinks of you know, Catholic priests in the 60s and 70s who joined revolutionary movements in South America, like Camilo Torres, mm-hmm. All those who joined with the Cuban Revolution and such. You know, we come back to these models or stories of individuals and in their own groups who display some sort of courage, for whom the ethics of their politics is very difficult to kind of brand in some simplistic way,
right,
as good or bad.
You
know, they were heroes or they were evil. It's because real life is so messy, right?
I agree.
And in some sense, you know, we in Marxism, one talks about praxis, right? The idea is that practice has to, you know, with theory, the theory has to somehow encounter the world and that and must allow for itself to be transformed by it. Mm-hmm. And I think as individuals as well, you know, I remember myself as a 20-year-old, you know, and my sense of politics and how the last 20 years has taught me something. And because I've allowed myself to transform and change, you know, I think I've become much more optimistic, but in a different way. Optimism of my 20s is not the same optimism of my 40s.
And I think that's the thing that we have to aim for, a refinement of our feeling about our values. It is not sainthood. It is not martyrdom. You know, and sometimes that's the problem. We want so much moral consistency. We forget the nuances of being moral. And by that, I mean the complexity of the choices. You know, the circumstances beyond our control that animate, that move us to make the difficult choices that we make, that's the richness. It's not in the moral claims you make or the kind of ideals you have to be a saint. And in, on that point, I do want to highlight as well why I find it disturbing lately that people are questioning the necessity of birth at this time, you know. That's a very... I find that some of the demographic that has always rallied behind birth is showing, I find, a kind of unfair hesitance. And I understand that it's part of the democratic process, so on and so forth. But I find that very interesting in that this is only the beginning of the journey, you know? And while it's good to have these vibrant discussions, some of the opposition might be a bit uncharitable.
We have two other voices we wanted to bring into this conversation, Fuad. Lauren Berlant and Michel Foucault. Mm-hmm. Foucault, of course, is somebody we've talked about before, but not Berlant. And who do you want to start with first?
So Lauren Berlant has this very interesting term, you know, that's making rounds in social theory these days, and that's this idea of cruel optimism. And she's talking particularly about the kind of neoliberal context where we are... always on this race and cycle to continuously enrich ourselves through work. And this requires a certain propelling of optimism. You know, the idea, if you work hard, it'll pay off. If you play by the rules, you'll get something in the end. If you're a good employee, rewards will come. And I think we've reached a point in history where we can throw sufficient skepticism against this idea. But not only that, but what is it doing to our psychic health? That when we latch on to these aspirations, we're actually doing more harm and cruelty. In fact, trauma is an emotional injury to ourselves than we realize. But we allow ourselves to be subjected to that because... we are optimistic. So it's a kind of not only misplaced optimism, but the actual effects is actually cruel when you think about what it actually does to us. So in that sense, a very useful phrase to kind of describe what we take to be normal life.
So is she saying then that the way we view life is something akin to a fantasy, that we have these optimistic fantasies about how life might unfold? And therefore makes us ill-prepared for the realities. If we take the examples you gave of the hardworking employee, right? One day the currency collapses, the market for your company disappears overnight, and you're thrown out of a job. I mean, there's no job security, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. But because you never entertain the possibility that we live in a world where the economic system doesn't guarantee, you know, security, but we believe it does because... we kind of operate in that world. We are ill-prepared
is one thing, but she wants to show what we're doing to ourselves as we endure the optimism. You know, there is
so how does it injure ourselves?
Think of the just bodily, the kind of bodily strains at the workplace, the kind of sterile lighting, the kind of psychic, the Sharad was looking at our lighting
the
here.
The lighting, yeah. You think, oh, it's soft.
But also a lot of work-related illnesses, the tension, the stress, the absence of any sense of community or the erosion of camaraderie because of competition. All these things actually take a toll.
But what if you had a workplace where the lighting was soft and you had annual holidays and everybody went on a break together, you know?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that then be a kind of response to the...
Are you describing BFM, Sharad?
No.
No, I think, of course, there are ways to mitigate workplace discomfort. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But fundamentally, there's no going around the idea that our lifestyle requires a certain dose of optimism that really flies against the face of evidence of its damages. The fact that we might want to separate and distinguish or distance the cause and effect is very interesting as well. And this is part of the problem in that we tend to isolate work life from real life. The idea that we can just bracket and segment the effects of what happens at work with how it influences how we feel and stuff like that. So, but all this is suspended by this driver of willingness to work that is fueled by a certain kind of optimism. And I think it might not directly dovetail our discussion on Malaysia, but I do sense that there is this frustration, even at a tacit level across the nation right now, when people talk about how devalued the currency is, when people talk about how unfair GST is to working families, when people talk about how dark and gloomy and pessimistic the economy will look like in the near future, there is in the subtext the idea that we're working for nothing, that our optimism that we place on our everyday routine is being challenged by the realities of the fact that we have little control over the economy and stuff like that.
I wonder if it's time to bring in Michel Foucault. Mm-hmm. At this point, the idea that with so many social theorists, especially as they build a portrait of how the world operates, they tend to build it in such a way as to suggest that it's a perfectly working machine, that there's no give in it, right? So that one might come away with the idea that we are all trapped within these structures, that even the agency that we feel or we're told we have is merely a symptom of the structure. The structure mm-hmm. is what is real, and agency in some ways is kind of illusory, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And every time a social theorist builds this portrait, they're helping us feel trapped. Mm-hmm. And whether it's got to do with economic systems, or in the case of Michel Foucault, a certain systems of discoursing about the world, of thinking or imagining the world, that also, again, traps people.
I think that's a great way to set up the intellectual context of this quote. And I just want to also add that as a result of that, as a result of his emphasis on how discourse limits our understanding of agency, or how the self is really an illusory phenomena, Foucault was also a consistent critic of the Marxist political project. I feel that he actually engages with Marx more than people give him credit for. Like, the book Discipline and Punish is a very Marxist-friendly book. But if you look at his political statements as a public intellectual, he was very steadfast in critiquing the Marxist notion of history. And as a consequence, the intellectuals and the movements that support that vision of history. So, and we got to just put ourselves in that context where it was a very vibrant French philosophical discourse that was very active. There was this idea that public intellectuals or philosophers must also be involved in so-called changing the world. But here comes Foucault with his pessimism. And this is where he addresses that topic when it was posed to him. Is he a pessimist, right? What's going on here? What can we hope for? He responds by saying, quote, "My point is not that everything is bad, but that everything is dangerous, which is not exactly the same as bad. If everything is dangerous, then we always have something to do. So my position leads not to apathy, but to hyper and pessimistic activism. I think that the ethical political choice we have to make every day is to determine which is the main danger."
Which is the main danger of the many dangers that mm-hmm. we have, right? Mm-hmm.
Okay. What do you think, Sharad?
Well, if you think of it in terms of the trade-offs we have to make, right? So in choosing to do one thing, for instance, could be overthrowing a government or whatever, or focusing on our moral life, for instance, there's always something that's going to be left behind, mm-hmm. not just as individuals, but as groups, right? Mm-hmm. We have to make some priorities. Mm-hmm. And so weighing the uncertainty, the mm-hmm. consequences, not all of which are available for us to understand mm-hmm. when we embark on some course of action, is part of the twin nature of any action. There's good and bad. There's the possibility evil in good and mm-hmm. good even in evil. And I think Niebuhr, again, talks about those things. And that kind of moral complexity is something that we all, well, the most of us reject mm-hmm. because it's difficult. We reject it. We want certainty. We want to believe. And if we talk about our choices as if they were... clear that mm-hmm. that the good from it is unproblematic, and we create the illusion for others because we want to sell the idea to somebody else. You say, well, let's go out and march tomorrow, but you know, there's this consequence and that consequence. This could happen to you, and this could be the repercussions for you personally, professionally. We don't want to talk about those things because it makes it too messy. Right? Mm-hmm. We want to give people clear moral choices, and that is probably the worst thing we can do. In some sense, we can say, well, the choice is clear to this extent and no more than that.
Yeah. And I like it that he uses pessimism as a kind of radar. That when you're pessimistic, the best way to make something out of your pessimism, since it's going to be there anyway, is to not make it about you. You know, use it as... a radar is a way to hone your instincts about what the dangers are. You feel that something is negative, you feel that something looks ominous, feels ominous. Pause then, say, what exactly is it? Refine it and see, oh wow, there is a lot of danger. Oh wow, why? And then from there, you can start thinking about what danger to prioritize. And there are a lot, you have to make choices, you know? So I think that's a good reminder to say that, yeah, we don't want pessimism, but it turns out we can actually do something with it. And that's what Foucault suggests.
Right. I think the distinction that needs to be made is between pessimism and cynicism. And I think cynicism is something we want to avoid because mm-hmm. that's just taking all the possibilities out of mm-hmm. any kind of social action. Mm-hmm.
And that's great. You can be a pessimist without being a cynic. So keep that in mind, folks. At any rate, those are really five interesting vantage points into optimism and pessimism. I'm sure you want to suggest that interesting piece about Niebuhr, Sharad.
Yeah, it's from the New York Review of Books. It's a work by Adam Kirsch. He's basically doing a review of a new collection that's come out on the works of Reinhold Niebuhr in religion and politics. Piece is called The Ironic Wisdom of Reinhold Niebuhr. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. that would be something I would suggest. In fact, any of the people that we've, you know, social theorists, I think the utopian and dystopian dimensions of each of the kind of thinkers that we've presented over the last 2 years, I think, add up to a complex discussion about optimism and pessimism.
That's at the heart of philosophy, really. One book I want to suggest, which isn't actually a philosophy or social theory, it's sort of like a new age, I don't know, discourse
earthy
or
crunchy,
something.
A little bit. Tree-hugging.
But it's actually very good. I enjoyed it nonetheless. It's called Active Hope. It's by Joanna Macy and Chris Johnstone. And it's really just about that. How do you find hope in a world that really, I mean, if you really look at the facts, it's really falling apart very, very quickly, you know, and we're in the thick of the apocalypse. Well, maybe not the thickest part, but...
Well, thank you very much. I've just taken a mortgage.
So, look that up. It's an easy read, very, very eloquently written and very conversational in style. So as usual, though, feel free to tweet Sharad at Sharad Kutan, that's his handle. Or you can email us at bfmnightschool@gmail.com or look us up on Facebook, just like BFM Night School on the search space, and you'll find us there. Be sure to like it and tell your friends about us. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, joined as always by Sharad Kutan, and you've been listening to Night School on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.